So it's my joy to welcome you to the seventh lecture of the Machine Learning for Greenhorns. Thank you for coming. At the beginning, are there any questions regarding to any theory or assignments or anything? Feel free to even write it to the chat if you want to. Well, if there are no questions, or if the questions if the questions arrive later, then I will deal with them. And that because it seems none of them are coming, then let's get to the lecture. Last time we talked about the SVM algorithm, which can be used to perform binary classification. And the good thing of the algorithm was that it can use the so-called dual formulation, where the algorithm can maybe that was a bit more detailed place to start. So we talked about the so-called primary and dual formulations, and all other algorithms so far, or most of them, were in this the primary formulation, where we just have some fixed number of weights and we train them, for example, using an SGD algorithm. And what we can do is we can actually change the way how we represent the W, and instead of fixed set of weights, we could learn weights for the individual training examples. And we can use the same algorithms as we already saw in the primary formulation, in the dual formulation. And the good thing is that in the dual formulation, we can consider feature spaces which are much larger than the input features. For example, we could consider a kernel of order 3 or 4, which has a very large feature space. However, in this dual formulation, we can work with it efficiently. And that is caused by the so-called kernel trick, some ways how we can evaluate the scalar product in these feature spaces efficiently. And we talked about several kernels. Some of them were the polynomial kernels, and the other one was the RBF kernel, which was a kernel which was a combination of all the polynomial kernels in a sense, and it actually measured the distances between the examples. And now and then we talked about the SVM algorithm, which is an algorithm for binary classification, and it can be actually formulated also in this dual version, which was interesting and allowed us to use these kernels, including the RBF kernel, during classification. So when we trained the algorithm, what we did is that we said, okay, we want to find a linear separator, the linear decision boundary, such that the distance of all the points to that boundary is maximal. It's sometimes it's called the maximum margin classifier. And by looking at the geometry and thinking about the conditions, we arrived at the following optimization formula. We try to minimize the size of the weights, given that all the points are on the good side of the margin, of the decision margin. We were able to actually solve this problem. We were able to solve this problem by using the Lagrange multipliers and reformulate the solution in the so-called dual formulation. So in the primary formulation, we have got the weights here. And then if we want to find the solution to the constraint problems, we turn to extension of the Lagrange multipliers, right? In the Lagrange multipliers, we were able to solve an optimization problem for some function f by including some equality constraint. But now we need also inequality constraint. And when we did it, we use the same Lagrangian as in the equality case. So we took the function which we want to minimize and edit lambda times g, where the lambda is the Lagrange multiplier. And we consider two cases. Either this maximum can be found inside the region which we are interested in which case we call this constraint inactive. And we used lambda zero for it. So it really removed this condition from the Lagrangian. But the more interesting case is the situation where the constraint is going to be active, which means that the solution will be found at the boundary, right at the edge of the constraint. So right in the situation where the gx is zero. And in this situation, even if the underlying function f doesn't really have a maximum at that point, it can be maximum considering the constraint, because if the function grows in the direction outside of the constraint, then this may be the maximum with respect to the constraint, because we cannot go in the direction where the function f increases. And this happens when the gradient of f is equal to the gradient of g times minus times lambda. The gradient of f is this direction where the f grows. The gradient of g points inside this space. So if they are collinear, like they are on the same line, but opposite of each other, then we know that we have found local maximum. So in the end, the solution to the inequality case was as before. We do the Lagrange multipliers, the Lagrangian, we compute the partial derivatives. And if the we found a point which is the maximum of the Lagrangian and these conditions apply, then we have found, I have to do it the other way around. So if we have the maximum to the constraint optimization, then the partial derivatives of the Lagrangians are zero and these conditions apply. However, what I started saying is that for some specific choice of the objective function and the equality and the inequality constraints, these are even sufficient conditions. So if we find maximum of the Lagrangian such that these conditions hold, then we have found the maximum of the original optimization problem. And using this, we were able to find the minimum of this optimization problem by forming the Lagrangian, where we have the length of the weights, and then our constraints are that the points are on the correct side of the decision boundary, and we have as many Lagrange multipliers as there are training data. In order to find the solution, we consider the derivatives with respect to W and B, and we have shown on the last lecture that these results in these conditions or in these formulations, like how the W should look like and that all the sum of AITI must be zero. And when we plugged those into the original function, we got this formulation. And good thing about this is that all these phis got together, so we could replace them by the kernel, and now we can use the kernel trick. We also thought about what does this third condition apply, and what does it apply? Well, during prediction time, we compute the kernel of the given point and xi, like all the training points, and then we weight their like using the size of the kernel as the weight, the relevance of this point of the prediction, and we multiply it by the AI, the TI. This AI is like a trained weight, how much this point actually influenced the result. And this, know that this AI that's non-negative, right? And this TI, that's the target, so it's either plus or minus one. So this is a constant, which is a real value, which tells us how much this point influences the results either to the positive case if AI TI is larger than zero, or to the negative case if AI TI is less than zero. And for the points where AI is zero, well, we are not interested in them because they don't change the prediction. So the only interesting points where the AI was strictly greater than zero, for these points, we knew that this TI YXI must be one, which means only the points on the margin are the ones which have non-trivial constant and non-trivial value. So it's fine to keep only some part of the training data, right? So even if this is a non-parametric method, it doesn't necessarily need to store all the data, but only those which have some non-trivial influence on the result. So here we can consider the points which are linearly separable when using the Gaussian kernel. So they are not separable in the original space, but they are separable using this kernel. This black part, that's the decision boundary, right, at the middle. And then we have the margins here, which is here and here. So you can see that only the points on the margin that are the ones which with the green circle around them that are the support vectors. So that are the ones which have non-zero AI, which are then used for prediction. So after training, we only need to remember this set of points, and the rest is just implied just by these ones. So this is what we did on the last lecture, and now we will extend this. We will extend our work from the previous week to a situation where the input set of points is not linearly separable. That was one of the problems in the original formulation. We assumed that it is possible to actually separate the data, and we try to do it by using the maximum margin. This is sometimes called a hard margin variant because everybody has to be on their side of the decision margin. However, we now relax this condition to allow to train also on data which are not linearly separable. And what we do, this extension is called the soft margin. If you don't say anything special, then soft margin is the SVM. So what we need to do, we need to allow points to be on the bad side, on the wrong side of the margin, right? If the points are linearly non-separable, then that must happen. Some of the points will be on a bad side. We will, but of course we want to minimize these situations. So what we do is we define the so-called slack variables, which will tell us how much does a specific point breaks or not fulfills this condition. And we do it by measuring the distance between the point and the corresponding margin, right? So for example, for this point, this would be the slack variable. For this point, this would be the slack variable. Right, so it's the distance of the corresponding margin. How do we measure it? Well, if we are on the right side of the margin, then of course we pay zero. But if we are on the bad side of the margin, we just measure the distance from the margin. The YXI tell us the distance from the margin. From the decision boundary. Right, now we need to measure the distance not from the decision boundary but from the margin, and the margin is just offsetted by plus or minus one depending on whether we are talking about the positive or the negative case, right? So I don't know if we have got this YXI, then the let's say that this is the it measures distance in this direction. So if we go to the, if we use the minus, then we are measuring the distance on the bad side, and then for the TI will move us here, right? So we really measure the distance on the opposite side. So if this so-called slack variable is zero, it means we have been classified, not only classified correctly, but we are also on the correct side of the margin. If this slack variable is between zero and one, then we are still correctly classified because we are on the correct side of the decision boundary, but we are already like inside the margin. Then if this slack variable is one, we are exactly on the decision boundary. And if it's larger than one, then we even do perform a incorrect prediction for this point. So it's on the opposite side of the separate of the separating hyperplane. So what we want to do is we want to optimize the original function, but we need to include the slack variables. To include the slack variables, we just add the sum of the slack variables to the objective function, and we need to give it some weight. So we use weight C because these two criteria, one for trying to have the margin as wide as possible and misclassifying points or like allowing the points to be inside the margin or even on the other side, then these go against each other, right? So we need the C value, which will tell us or which will allow us to specify which of these two sides of the trade-off do we really want to take. And the condition which we now have is that the point must be on the margin or on the margin, but it can be off by this slack variable, and these slack variables are non-negative. This C weight will play a role of some regularization, which we will saw, which we will see in several slides. So technically, to solve or to reformulate the primary formulation into a dual one, we take the loss. This is just the loss, that's simple. And then we form the Lagrangian, so we need to add the conditions. One of the conditions is that we are on the right side of the margin modulo the slack variable. So that's this one, using the AI as Lagrange multiplier. And then we also have a set of constraints that all these slack variables are not negative. So we add these constraints by their own Lagrange multiplier mu I. So this is the Lagrange multiplier. So in order to make it easier, in order to get rid of these W's, we will use the same approach as in the hard margin case. We compute the derivative with respect to W and B. That's, we already did that. But this time also with respect to the slack variables. So let's do it. The loss with respect to slack variable I is, so no slack variable here. Here we have C times slack variable I, so it's just C. Now we have done this. No slack variable here, no slack variable here. Here we have got slack variable I. So when computing the derivative, we will get minus AI, right? So this went from here, this went from here. So now we have dealt with this sum, and the last element is this one. And if we compute the gradient with respect to slack variable I, we get mu I, right? And if we then set this partial derivative to zero, we get that this mu I is Lagrange multiplier for the slack variable I is just C minus AI. So in fact, the new Lagrange multiplier is just very tightly connected with the original Lagrange multipliers. So then by substituting all these three conditions or equations into the original formulation, we get this. The L is the same as before, just apart from the slack variables. So let's look at how the slack variables will influence the final equation. Well, you can see that they are not there, so they should ideally cancel out. So let's consider it. So we will get C times the sum of the slack variables, right, from here, then minus AI times the slack variable that comes from this part, and then we have how I cannot fit it here. So minus sum of the mu I slack variable I, right, that goes from this side. However, if we now take into account that this mu I is C minus AI, and this mu is C minus AI, that means that all these three elements will actually cancel out, right? Because this one is exactly the opposite of the other ones, right? You can see C minus A and mu I. So the slack variables will not make it into the loss function which we want to minimize. They only make it to the conditions which need to hold. Compared to the previous case, when we had these conditions, there is one more condition which we need to fulfill, and that's that the AI must be at most C, right? That's because this mu I multipliers must also be non-negative, so the largest AI which we can have has the value of C. In a sense, this is consistent with our previous solution, because in the hard margin, we do not allow the points to be on the bad side of the margin. So how we can simulate it by using C, which is infinity or extremely high, right? Because then if a point is on the bad side of the decision boundary, we will pay an extremely high penalty, which means that, like, in the limit, if the data is linearly separable, then we will just separate it without allowing any points on the incorrect side. If you look at it from this view, then previously we didn't include this constraint that this AI must be limited by C, but in the hard margin case, this C was in fact plus infinity. Right, so this was in a sense already a constraint, but because of the infinity value of C, we just didn't realize that it was there. So this is just a strict generalization of the previous case, and by allowing to specify the value of C, we can either get a solution we never allow the point to be on the bad side of the margin, or we allow it by being able to create a larger margin. There is an example here, where you can see that we have data which are not probably linearly separable in any space, but the algorithm still converges, and you can see that it finds quite a lot of support vectors. The support vectors are once again the examples where the AI is larger than zero. And for these situations where the AI is larger than zero, we know that the TI YXI is equal to 1 minus the slack variable, which means the point is either on the decision boundary, on the margin, as before, but it can also be inside the margin or even on the other side of the decision boundary. So for example, in this blue cloud here on the left, you can see that there is one red point, and this red point is the support vector. Right. Also, the margin is not visualized here in this example, but it probably looks something like this. Right. Looking at what vectors were chosen as the support vector, what points were chosen as the support vectors. And the same on the right side, you can see that there are a lot of blue points here, which are on the incorrect side of the decision boundary. So all of those are support vectors. So in this extension, the SVM can solve even the problems which are not linearly separable. And so how does the primary formulation look like? Well, we have seen that the loss we want to minimize is C times the sum of the slack variables, and then the length of the weights. So these slack variables, they measure for each example, like the error, like how, if the model doesn't with some sureness, with some good probability, say that this is the that it correctly classifies it, then we need to pay something for it. Like, so we are interested in the points where the slack variable is larger than zero, and these are the points where we didn't predict their position far enough from the decision boundary. So they are either in the margin or even on the bad side. When we have a specific point, then we can measure these slack variables using this formula. That's exactly just what we did here, but it's reformulated somehow. We say, okay, it's the larger one from zero and the one minus ti y xi. Yep. So now when we have these slack variables, we can imagine that they are computed as the maximum of this zero and one minus target time to prediction. We could call this to be a loss function. Well, and it is actually a loss function. It's called Hinge loss function. And then rewrite the result using the Hinge loss. And this would look quite similar to what we have seen in the other examples as well, right? There is some loss which measures the distance of the prediction with respect to the target variable. And we can see that we also have the L2 regularization term, and we have got this constant C, which we can imagine not to be here, but to be here, one over C. Right. So it's in fact regularization strength, but it's the opposite of it. Right? If C is zero, then we don't look at the data at all because this is just not there. Right? So if C is zero, we just want to satisfy the L2 regularization. If on the other hand, C is infinity, it means we just ignore this constraint and we are only interested in the data itself. So, looking at the models which we have seen so far, then they generally tried to minimize the loss on the data, optionally plus the regularization term. In case of linear regression, this loss was just mean square error. In case of the logistic regression, well, if we consider just the linear output of the model, like in the generalized linear models, we know that there is linear output and some nonlinearity, then we can imagine that this nonlinearity is hidden inside the loss, right? So for example, for logistic regression, we can consider the model to predict the logits itself, and then we could have a loss, which is the logarithm of the activation of the data, right? The same for softmax, and the SVM looks follows the same pattern. It we want to minimize some error function on the data plus the regularization term. So that's what the primary formulation of the SVM looks like, similar to as before, but we use a new loss function. It's a Hinge loss function. So why do we use it? We don't just go for the negative log likelihood. Like we said that this maximum likelihood estimation has several advantages, that it converges to the correct solution, and then it's like the least noisy consistent estimator. So the reason is that we want our solution to be sparse. Otherwise, we would need to remember all the data would need to be support vectors. But if the method should be practical, then we need some of the data to be left out so that only some part of the training data is support vectors, which will make the model more practical. To show the visual differences between the function, consider the following reformulation. Like, let's assume that we are trying to do a binary classification, and we assume that the targets are minus one or plus one, just because it will be the best setting so where to combine all the loss functions which we have used so far. So for mean square error, we know that the loss which we want to compute is y minus t squared, right? Prediction minus the target value. So what we can do, well, we can multiply it by this by t squared, because t squared is just one, right? Which means we can get the t inside. So this is the same as ty minus t squared, and t squared is one. So this is just ty minus one, right? So we can look at it like this. The model generated the prediction ti, and we wanted it to be one. When we consider the logistic regression, then the loss will be the negative log likelihood. I'm sorry, the negative log is missing here. I will add it later. And the loss looks either like minus logarithm of the sigma of y, if the target is one. Right? Probability of producing the correct output is the probability predicted by the model for this output to actually be correct. And for the case where we want to predict the opposite, the negative case, then the loss is the logarithm of one minus sigma of the prediction, right? Because we want the negative class to be the correct one. And so the probability which the model assigns to this negative class is one minus what it assigns to the positive class. And now we can realize, you can verify, it's difficult to realize this, that the sigmoid of y, or let's do it like this, one minus sigmoid of I, right, that's this. Well, that's actually just the sigmoid of minus y, right? So this one minus sigma of y, it can be just sigma of minus y. Now we can see that we can actually simplify both these cases to just minus logarithm of the sigmoid function of ty. So we do the same prediction, ty, but we measure the loss using the sigmoid function, right? So we either want to generate, get plus infinity or minus infinity, and if we are not there, well, we never are, then the loss, the negative log likelihood will tell us how large should be update the parameters to get even further to the place where we want to. And in the SVM, we have already discussed that the loss is one minus t times y, right? So in all these cases, the model just predicts some y, and we consider ty. And in the mean square error, we are satisfied only when the prediction is exact. If the model performs even larger prediction, right? If it says, oh, I'm much more sure than just 100% that this is the class of the model, then it gets penalized for it. Like the MSE has just the minimum directly in this value. For the logistic regression, the loss looks like this. So it's logarithmically grows on the left side. And then gets very slowly to zero, right? So the further we are to the right, the better. But the model is also never satisfied, in a sense that even if we say, oh, here we are, then the model says, go more to the right, we can assign even higher probability to this example. So it never stops learning, compared, for example, to perceptron, which just stops when it classifies everything correctly. However, this always more can cause overfitting easily. For the SVM, the loss, that's the hinge loss, looks like this. It's the t times y, so that's the, let's say that we want t1, right? So minus t times y is just this. And then if we do one minus, we get this function, right? And then we say maximum of this and zero, well, then we get this loss. So if the model predict is like on the bet, like we get even incorrect class. If the prediction is really bad, then we of course pay some error, and the error is linear in the size of the or in the length of in the distance between the prediction and the right of the margin. We even pay some penalty here, which is the situation where we are on the right side of the decision boundary. So the prediction would be even correct, but we are too close to it, right? So we all want all the points to be on the margin if possible. But once we get to the margin, the loss is just zero. So it doesn't distinguish the points which are outside of the margin. And this is one of the reasons why the solution will be sparse, because we just don't try to make the predictions for the points which are sufficiently enough far from the decision boundary. So we don't try to make the prediction for these points any better. And that's why we can get a sparse solution. If we use the negative log likelihood, then the negative log likelihood tries to improve performance in other points, even the ones which are classified very, very correctly already. So this is just a comparison of the primary formulations of these algorithms. Now I will talk about the about an algorithm which can be used to actually solve the dual formulation of the SVM. But before I get to it, let me first talk about like the comparison of SVM with regard to the other algorithms and so on. So first, consider this primal and dual formulation. So assume that we have got the training data set with n training examples, and they have d features, so the size of the input dimensionality. And we use a feature map phi, which generates some number of, larger number of features. So for example, for quadratic features, it would be d squared. For RBF, this is infinity. So in the primal formulation, we have as many parameters as there are features, while in the dual formulation, we have as many parameters as there are examples. We store all these parameters into the model in the primal formulation, while in the dual formulation, we only store as many examples as there are support vectors. So we don't need necessarily to store all the all the weights. We store just the examples of the support vectors plus the corresponding AITI to that point. And the training time is size of the data times the feature space times some constant for the number of iterations in the primal formulation. In the dual formulation, this is specifically the complexity of the training algorithm for SVM. Then that's something between linear and quadratic with respect to the number of points and linear in the dimensionality. So if this F is sufficiently large, larger than D, then using this dual formulation might be better. However, if we have extreme number of points, then the primal formulation is the one which we want to use, right? So the dual formulation is good if we have some moderate number of data and we are interested in rich feature spaces, and then it can be useful to use it. Specifically, for the quadratic features, the boundary is very, very narrow. Like it doesn't make that much difference to go in the primal or the dual formulation. But the interesting thing is the RBF kernel, of course. And with the RBF kernel, it's very difficult to train it in the primal formulation. Well, we will talk about how it can be done, but for the RBF kernel, this F is infinity. For the RBF kernel, it's not about just the complexity, but it's even about the possibility to actually train the algorithm. And yeah, an inference time is just the size of the model. It's not really that important. People actually like SVM with RBF, or they liked it. And I still think that in some cases, it's a very useful algorithm. What does it do is that it's like a KNN algorithm on steroids, right? It performs the prediction by measuring the distance of the given point some chosen points of the whole data. And for each of these chosen points for the support vectors, it has trained weight, which tell you like how important is the proximity to this support vector important to the final prediction. And if like generally when we are predicting something for the values which you like if you are doing generalization, like you got some number of training points and now I want to generalize for like for a given point, then assuming that the function is somehow local, like locally smooth, means that you probably want to look like around and then somehow be guided by the most similar examples. And that's what the RBF kernel does exactly. Right? It actually measures the distance to these training data. And then you get the prediction corresponding to the closest point. So in a sense, this algorithm is like the best thing which you can do. And for the data sets which are of a moderate size, this may be the best performing algorithm because it allows you to use a very rich feature space, RBF kernel, without actually needed to learn it, right? So we can get very powerful representation without needing any data for it. Which means the results might be the best. When you compare this to this MLP, then the MLP need to train also the representation or the mapping to the feature space. And if you don't have enough data, then it may easily overfit. While here in SVM, we already use a nonlinear mapping, which is given. Right, so it might be useful to actually use this given rich mapping without actually creating your own. So if you have a lot of data, then you can create even a better one. But if you don't have enough data, then the SVM might be the algorithm for you. Yeah. So to have also a visual idea of what I'm saying, then there are links to the several demos in the slides, which you can use to play. So this is the soft margin SVM. What you can see here, where there are some green points, that's one of the classes, and the red points, that's the second of the classes. We try to train, or we just don't try, we actually train the soft margin SVM. You can see that the points are not linearly separable. So we end up having this green point on the bad side of the decision boundary. And so the size of the point depends on the trained Lagrange multiplier. So this very small red dots and these two very small green ones that are the points which are not the support vectors, and the rest of them are. And the larger the circles, the higher the A value is. You can see that we have got six support vectors out of 10. But of course, if we add some more points here, the red ones, and if we add some more green points to the opposite side, you can see that the number of the support vectors doesn't change. You know, it's just still six because the newly added points are outside of the margin. Now this this regularization strength corresponds to like the width of the margin which you want to get. And generally, if you want a wider margin, then you are fine by paying more for the slack variables. So let's say that we will make this value smaller, right? So when we make this value smaller, you can see that generally the margin is increasing, right? But of course, the penalties, the slack variables are getting larger and larger. On the other hand, if we would increase it, you will see that we are more and more unhappy about the points being on the incorrect side of the margin, which means we usually try to minimize the margin, right? Because if we make the margin smaller, then we might not pay as much for the slack variables. So it's in fact just a regularization strength. Like here, we just don't regularize at all, and here we just regularize and don't consider the data much. So this is the primal, or this is the linear kernel. Now consider the RBF, the Gaussian kernel. Now in this situation, you can see that the decision boundary is no longer just a line, but instead it goes through a region where the distance measured to the support vectors on the left and on the right side are somehow balanced or equal. So for example, in this situation, you can see that we have some number of support vectors here. These small points inside, they are not the support vectors, and the green ones, they are not, not as well. And then the decision boundary goes like here. And then this kernel sigma parameter, that's the gamma, which we what we designated as gamma. That's like the length scale of the RBF. It tells you like what close means. Right? Whether if the L2 distance is one, is it large or is it small? And that's what this gamma does. So now, when it's large, it means it considers even small lengths as quite large. So the predictions are usually made by considering the So I said it the other way around, right? So with this. Even a large distance is considered small, so the predictions for points depends on a larger neighborhood. Now, if it's going to get smaller, the predictions will start depending on smaller and smaller neighborhoods. Right, so you can see that you really need to be very close to the red points in order to be classified as red, otherwise the value is green. That's generally how the SVM works. It finds a base class, a baseline, and it predicts it everywhere, apart from the situations where you can see more training points of the opposite class. So here it decided to use the green class as the base one, and then in order to be predicted as red, you need to be reasonably close to the red points. Yep. What can happen? I don't know, let me add some more red points. If you look at the SVM, it can actually happen that the SVM predict this region to be green, even if there is no training data present in the region itself. And this is caused by the fact that for this green point, there are too many close red ones, which are stronger than the green one. So the green point itself is not classified as red. But if you go slightly down in this region, then the green point is the closest one, and the red ones are now far enough so that they don't overrule. They don't have enough strength to change value chipped in by this green point, right? So you can get predictions in the regions where there are actually no examples of this color, which is a bit peculiar, but that's exactly what the SVM does. Now comparing these decision boundaries just to the neural networks, you can look at this another example. We have got a very small MLP which uses the sigmoids as the activation function. Here you can see that the multilayer perceptron doesn't really choose one bias class or something. Instead, it just like cuts the space of the features into pieces. All right. So what it does is it tries to find the boundaries in the feature space, and then say, okay, this piece is classified as red, and this piece is classified as green. And here, because we have the activation function, which is nice and smooth, then also the decision regions are kind of smooth. And we know that if we use enough hidden layers, then we can actually learn any weird shaped decision boundary. So this was just some small visualization. Now we can consider one issue before we will get to the algorithm of training SVMs. And what we are going to talk about is the extension of the SVM to the case where we have multiple classes. The SVM by default is only a binary classifier, but in many cases we want to predict K classes. So without considering SVMs specifically, but just the general settings, assume that we can create binary classifiers and we would like to create a multi-class classifier. So I will present two schemes how to do it. One scheme is called one versus rest. So like one is fighting all the others. In this scheme, we train K classifiers, one for each class. So let's assume that we have got four classes. And what we do is we trained for each class, we train a classifier which tries to separate this class from all the rest of the data. So when you know the orange might learn this separator, that's light blue might learn this, this dark blue might learn this, and this green one might learn all this. Then during prediction, what we need is we need the classifiers to give us probability, right? So when we are predicting, this point, let's say this one, then we will measure the probability of the individual classifiers. All right, so the orange one may give us 0.7, I don't know. Then the blue one will give us slightly above 0.5, 55. And for the blue one, and dark blue one, and the green one, it's on the opposite side. So I don't know, it's 0.4, 0.3 or something, right? And then we might say, okay, so we see that the classifier which separates this class has the highest probability, so we will pronounce this result to be this class to be the result of the classification. For this to work, of course, the individual classifiers need to return the calibrate probabilities, right? It means these probabilities need to be comparable across the board. It might easily be the case that it might not be the truth. For example, this blue classifier might like return 0.5 for this, but for a very close region, it might already say 0.99 and 0.01 probability. So even for this one, which is just very close to the decision boundary, it might say 0.99, oh, it's me, and then it would win. But it's just because that this scale in this direction for the blue classifier and scale in this direction for the orange classifiers are not the same, right? So for this to work, we need the probabilities to be somehow compatible with each other. If you think about it, that's exactly what our softmax solution did. It predicted as many outputs as there are classes, and for each of these outputs, it says the probability of separating, probability of this output. So in a sense, it was probability of separating it from one of the last classes, separating it from the other ones. Like when we train it, we say it should be one for the corresponding class and zero for all the others. However, the softmax combines all the probabilities together, and that's the mechanism which performs or which is able to produce these calibrated probabilities. So like the softmax is a very specific version of this, but in softmax we don't train the classifiers independently, we train them all at the same time to make sure that they actually return probabilities which are comparable. In any case, this cannot be used for SVMs because SVMs doesn't return probabilities. It only can return the distances from the decision boundary, but these are distances and not probabilities, and they are also not calibrated across different various classes. So this is not the scheme which is which can be used for SVMs. Instead, SVM uses this one versus one scheme. In the one versus one scheme, we create smaller data sets for each class, for each pair of classes. We consider the data just consisting of samples of I and J class. And we create as many classifiers as there are pairs of classes. Each tries separating this this pair. So for example, if we have these four classes, which we had in the previous case, I probably should use the same colors. Then what we do is we train a classifier which separates the orange and the light blue, orange and the dark blue, and orange and the light green. We of course do it for all the other ones, but this allows us to get I don't know, like a score of how many times this class was deemed better than all the other classes. Right, so we measure for each pairs, like how many times each class wins, like how many votes does the class get, because a classifier trying to separating two classes, one of them is being the one in question, said that it's the better one. Right, so for each class, we can get, if there are k classes, we can get at most k minus one votes. And in the end, we just return the class with the majority. So this is what the SVM used, because for this, it's just enough to get the predictions, just the classifications without any scores, which is what the SVM is good for. However, it means we need to train a lot of classifiers, I don't know, 45 for case in case of 10 classes. However, these are trained on smaller parts of data. So in the end, it's similarly slow as training the K classifier, so on the whole sets of data. It's not probably exactly true. Maybe let's count it. I haven't really computed it at all, but let's say that we have got N training data. So in the first case, we are training. Let's say that Tn is the cost of training of N data. So in the one versus rest is k times tn, and in the one versus one we train roughly k squared classifiers, but the size of each training is 2n over k, right? Because we just take n over k, let's say approximately that's the number of instances for the class, and we are training on two classes. So assuming that the t of n like if this would be linear, then this would be kn, and this would be 2 times kn, right? And if the training is, I don't know, if it would be quadratic, then this would be this would even be better, right? Because this would be k squared times 2n divided by k squared, so this would cancel out, and this would even be a bit faster. So even if we are training more classifiers, it's not like the training time is improves. However, the problem with the approach is of course caused by the fact that if we don't get probabilities, but instead we just vote, then there might be large regions where the voting just doesn't know because there is a tie. So if here are some regions where, and this one says, okay, so I am C1 and I'm not C1. This region says, okay, I am C2 and I'm not C2. Then here, like both of them say that this is the case. So this is C1 and C2. So we don't know what to do. And in case of three classifiers, then you can easily get regions where there are ties. And without any probability, you just cannot get any more information. So that's why we don't do it like this. And in the softmax prediction, we get the probabilities. And with the probabilities, there are no large regions with ties. There are, of course, decision boundaries where the prediction changes, but there are not large regions of the space where the predictor actually doesn't know and just flip a coin to choose one of these classes. So this was the way how we can generalize SVMs to K-classes. And now let's get to the last topic of today's lecture. And that's an algorithm which we can use to train SVM. And specifically to train the dual formulation of SVM. For that, an algorithm which is called a sequential minimal optimization, SMO algorithm, is being used. It's already more than 20 years ago, but it's the algorithm for training the dual formulation of the SVM. And how we train it? We train it by the so-called coordinate descent algorithm. So coordinate descent is a version of an SGD. Seeing that we want to solve some minimization with respect to some number of arguments. So with SGD, we just compute the gradient in all the parameters and then just update all of them. In the coordinate descent, we solve this problem one parameter by one parameter by another, right? So instead of changing all of the weights at the same time, we take only one of these weights and then compute the minimum of the loss function or somehow minimize the function with respect just to this one version. That's why it's coordinate descent, because we do, like you could imagine SG on the individual coordinates. We can then iterate either randomly, or we can iterate randomly through the coordinates, or usually when this is done, then you just go sequentially from the first to the last one. And why does this work, or why this might be a good idea? Well, the important thing is how well we can solve this inner optimization problem. Because when we are trying to optimize just for one way, then we might do better than just use an SGD, right? We in many cases, can actually find the weight such that it will really minimize the loss. Like we will really find the local optimum with respect to this one argument, right? Once you look at the loss with respect to just one of the arguments, then it can be it may happen that it is just a quadratic function, right? So in the SGD, we will just move to the minimum. But if we are updating just one of these parameters, then we can just analytically go directly to the optimum, right? So we are optimizing only one parameter, but that may allow us to do it better. And that's exactly what happens here on this image. So we want to go up and down, and what we do is we go to the minimum value that's here. Then we'll go horizontally, so we'll go to the minimum value, right? And then once again, and you can see that we can get to the solution in some reasonable number of steps. In SGD, we would just do something like this. Right, but in SGD you make sure that these steps are not large, because if they are large enough, then we will just be jumping over the solution, while in this coordinate ascent we just go to the best solution possible. Also, we've already seen an algorithm which does this, and that was the kernel linear regression. If we use the batch size of one in the kernel linear regression, then what we did, these weights that were the betas, which we tried to learn, and we only updated one of them using the value of all other ones, right? So even if this idea of the coordinate ascent seems weird, it in some situations corresponds to use batches of size one, which is still sometimes being performed. So it might not be such a bad idea. So we are trying to minimize the loss in the soft margin SVM, for which we need to fulfill some number of conditions. These are the conditions which we got when we got to this formulation, but we also get the KKT conditions, right? Because we are solving an inequality constraint task. We know that we need this complementary slackness to hold. So what we need to hold, the difficult one is the AI times the TI YXI minus one minus the slack variable needs to be zero, right? So either with this or this one needs to be zero. So we can reformulate it in the following way. So if the AI is zero, so if this part is not zero, then we need this ti y x y to be closer or equal to 1. Well, that's just saying that this is 0, right? Because if this is 0, then this ti y x I is exactly 1 minus slack variable I, and we know that the slack variables are non-negative. And then we will also consider the case where the AI is less than C. We know that this is one of these KKT conditions which need to hold. And then we also have this mu I, slack variable I, needs also to be 0. And so in order to reformulate this, you can remember that this mu I is just C minus AI. Right, so if this is larger than 0, that means if AI is smaller than C, then this slack variable needs to be 0, which is exactly as saying this, that this TIYXI is greater or equal to 1. Right, because the slack variable in this case is just not there. And by the way, if we combine both of these constraints, we get that this ti yxi needs to be 1. So what does it mean from the point of the solutions? When the AI is 0, then we don't know much, but these points are not support vectors, so we are not interested in them. If AI is larger than 0, but it's smaller than C, then the TIYXI is equal to 1, which means these points are exactly on the border, on the margin, right? Because their distance from the distance boundary is exactly 1, so they are exactly on the margin. And then if the AI is smaller than C, is equal to C, then these points are either on the margin or they are even inside the margin or on the opposite side of the decision boundary. So in order to solve our problem, what we will do, we will try to find the solution to we will try to find the solution to this optimization problem such that all these constraints must hold. Now, when we talk about the KKT conditions, either that under specific circumstances, these conditions, they are not sufficient, but also necessary, not necessary, but also sufficient conditions for finding the optimum. So what we will do is we will try to minimize this while fulfilling all of these conditions. And if all of these conditions are fulfilled and we have a minimum, then we know that we have found the minimum of the original optimization problem, and the original optimization problem was just a convex function. So the local optimum is also the global optimum, and we have succeeded. So how to do it? Well, at its core, we will just, the algorithms just coordinate descent. However, we cannot just change one of the AIs, right? The problem is that we know that we have this condition which tells us the sum of AI TI is 0. So changing one of the AIs is not possible because one cannot be changed. One of the AIs is defined by the rest of them, right? For example, A1 is just minus the sum of AI TI for I larger than 1. So what we will do is we will optimize two of these at the same time, right? We will optimize AI and JI, like a pair of coefficients. And for this pair of coefficients, we will minimize the loss while fulfilling the constraint. So what we will do is at all times, we will have the parameters which minimize the loss. but only given to some number of constraints, right? So this function, we will always keep it as low as possible, while only some subset of these conditions will hold. Once we will find the solution where all of these conditions hold, then we know that we have just found our minimum. So at the beginning, we say that AI and B are zero, right? That we get minimum loss using these values, which is great. That's a reasonably good minimum. And then we will check that all the conditions apply. So we will make sure that these are always the case. So the only condition with, which might not be satisfied are these KKT conditions. So until all of them are satisfied, we will perform an improvement. And by improvement, I mean that if we say, if we take I, where the condition is not satisfied, like we'll take one of the AIs, we want to change it. So we will take some other one, some J, and we will minimize the loss function such that the conditions are satisfied for these AI and AJ, right? So we will find a minimum. Some of these conditions might be invalidated by this, like the constraint, some of these might be invalidated by the new solution, but we hope that if we iterate long enough that we'll find the solution where all the constraints will be satisfied. And the algorithm will be like nice and successful because we will be able to solve this problem very efficiently. Specifically, we'll actually be able to find like the local optimum for these two values of AI and AJ. So why is it the case? First, we know that we want to, let's say, okay, let me start again, let's say that we want to perform this internal minimization. So we are given AI and AJ, and we want to minimize the loss function. So we have got two variables, but luckily we can express one using the other one, right? We know that the sum of the AKTK must be zero. So we can say, okay, AI can be computed by TI times some constant, minus AI TI. So the AI is just a linear mapping of AJ. Now we have got the loss. The loss is a function where which is linear in AIs, and it also contains this AI AJ elements. So it's linear and quadratic. And if we substitute the AI, it will still be a function where there will be linear and quadratic elements of AJ, right? So we have a function which is quadratic to AJ. That's great because if we just had a quadratic function, and then we know where to find the minimum, right? It's exactly here. So that's what we will do. We will just solve this minimization sub-problem optimally. Know that in the original algorithm, there are some heuristics how to choose a good AI and AJ such that the progress will be high when optimizing for this specific pair. We won't do that. So if you want the details, you will need to look into the original algorithm by itself. We will just use the AJ randomly whenever we found the AI invalidates or breaks or doesn't fulfill the conditions. So this is an overview of the whole algorithm. We get the data set, we get the targets, and we get some tolerance for numerical stability, the regularization parameter, the kernel, and the number, which tells us how much, like how long are we going to wait before we say that we have successfully passed through the data without changing anything. Like, it's difficult to find out whether whether this actually holds for all the values. So we will have some heuristic for that. And so so until we run out of patience, or until we went through the data without being able to change A's, then we go through all the I's. And what we do is we check the conditions. This is just a numerical reformulation of the conditions which we talked about. And these conditions, they were like, if AI is larger than zero, then the TI YXI must be smaller or equal to one, and the second one. So we check it, and if this doesn't hold, then we will choose J randomly. We will update the values, and then we'll say, okay, so we were able to actually improve the situation. If we see a pass where we didn't change the A's, then it seems nice. We weren't able to make progress on the iteration. But one of the reasons why we might not be able to make progress is because we have chosen a bad J. Like, it may be the case that when you choose AI and AJ, then for this specific pair, it's no way how to make progress. But for AI and some other AJ, you might want to, right? So it's not enough just to go once through this iteration, but we do that some number of times. And if we are actually able to go through, then we say, okay, so some of these constraints are not fulfilled, but maybe just they are just at the edge of the tolerance, and we weren't able to find any way how to improve it. So we say we are done. Now, the last part are the specific rules which will tell us how to actually update the AI NJ and beta. So how to explicitly solve this quadratic minimization problem. That's something what we will do on the practicals. So it's already in the slides, but we will go through the derivation on the practicals. You can think about it if you want until the time, or you can wait. But we'll do it directly on these practicals on Wednesday. So you will see actually the derivation at the same time when you will get the assignment, right? So compared to MLP, where I wanted you to try to solve it by yourself, here we will solve it together, because it's a bit more writing than for the MLPs. And that's nearly everything which I had in slides. First, are there any questions? Would you like to ask something? If not, then I would like to spend some time on the third demo, which I had here. And this time we will have a small demo of a visualization of a very simple neural network. Assume that we want to perform binary classification in 2D, so we have got two-dimensional inputs. And for example, we have this linearly non-separable case set of points. You can see that's not what I wanted to show you. The blue ones and the orange ones. Now, if we just used a linear activation, then we would just learn a linear model. And the linear model, of course, has very difficult time in separating the data. So the model, in the end, decides to draw the decision boundary somewhere, but it needs to be a linear one, so it's difficult. So generally, what you can see here, you can see the value of various features for all the input spaces. So if you look, if you like hover over this X1, what does it show you is what the value of this feature is for various points in on the input, right? So it has got this blue value, which means the zero, the white is zero, full blue is one, and then more than one is just the same full blue, right? So it's just linear scale in these x-axis, and the x2, that's just y, right? So that's a linear scale in this y-axis. Then you can also look at the individual neurons. So for example, this neuron computes this mapping. So for various points on the input, you can see what the output would be. Yeah, and then the final classification look like this. It's very just whitey because it's 0.5 nearly like on this scale. Of course, so we cannot solve this with a linear problem, but we could use feature engineering, right? So imagine that we also add x squared, like the quadratic feature of x to the input. Well, this allows us to measure the distance to the y-axis, and that allows the model to create like this parabolic decision boundary, which is a bit better than before, but of course not perfect. But if we also add the y squared, so if we have both x squared and y squared, then even a linear model can combine these features to measure distances. And once it can measure distances, it can form this decision boundary, which is just a circle, which just says, okay, if the distance from the origin is at most this value, then it's the blue class, and the large one is the orange class. If we add the quadratic features, then normally we would also add the x1, x2, but this doesn't really influence the result because in our case, it's just the squares of the x1 and x2, which makes the difference. Good thing is that once we start using non-linear activation, we don't need these quadratic features, right? Because we can construct useful features, non-linear features, automatically during training. And here you can see how they look like. But they are all straight because they are all rectified linear units, right? So you can see it's zero on this. I cannot just move the cursor from this. So the white region on the right, that's just the value where the real is zero. And then it starts producing some non-zero output, which just linearly grows more and more. And you can see that these four neurons, they just use some number of linear decision boundaries, but when they are combined together, the resulting shape looks like this, which contains several straight segments. So all these features, they are just straight planes, like half planes, but when you combine them, it's still a lot of things are linear, but you have got several linear points, so we can see that now we can easily separate all the points. If we add more neurons, then there is no guarantee that the decision boundary will be more smooth or something, because well, the network can just use some smaller number of the neurons. It doesn't need to learn more of them, use more of them. If we use the L2 regularization, then maybe the neural network would have motivation to use more of them, but it still doesn't seem so, right? It seems it still uses just three of them or something. But instead, if we use the hyperbolic tangent, that's nice and smooth function, then the resulting boundary will be more smooth, just because when we combine these individual functions, then they are not just planes, but they are really like these the like sigmoidal functions in 2D. Still, the final shape doesn't have to be a circle, but if we add the L2 regularization, that motivates the model to actually use like ideally all of them, so the result should be kind of smoother. So here you can play. There are also some different data sets which you can try to solve and see like for yourself visually what the results will look like. So this is interesting that it doesn't yeah, so you saw that the training was in some local minimum in the previous example, but when we restarted the training, it was able to learn this XOR data set neatly. Ideally, you can also try like what is the smallest number of neurons which you actually need to be able to solve the problem. You can see that the two are actually not enough. But three should be enough, right? So you can actually combine three lines in order to get the result. Well, you can see that it's not that great, but that's because we have too small capacity. If we create more neurons, then we should be able to create better separators. Yep, so this is just a small show to like see for yourself that even if we use the ReLU, which is not that much nonlinear function, we can combine all of these together to create quite a rich set of features. Well, according to the universal approximation theorem, actually general or all capable approximation. So I just got like the time of the lecture is just over. So there is a possibility for the last questions. Doesn't seem that there are any. Then thank you very much for your attention. Enjoy the state holiday tomorrow, and I hope we'll see each other on Wednesday when we will talk about the new competition assignment and also assignments regarding the SVMs. So until then, see you, bye-bye.